Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Can I request people to just move in the front? Good evening and Hare Krishna. Welcome to all the guests who have come here today. It's a very difficult day, I know, because some people were a little reluctant due to the 1.5 days Ganpati Visarjan. But thank you very much, whoever has been able to make it here today. So it's a pleasure as well as privilege to introduce His Holiness Bhakti Rasamrit Maharaj to you. For me personally and some other people who are here, he has been a friend, philosopher and guide for a number of years. I have known him from 1984 onwards, and we studied together. After he did his engineering, we did our management together from Mumbai. And I used to visit his house sometimes, and I was from the commerce field and he was from the science field, and I used to be boggled by the number of scientific books which he used to have. He was very active on the astronomy society and very deep into physics and some other subjects. I think in the course of maybe our meetings, he got introduced to the spiritual side of life, went very deeply into that subject matter, and at some point of time, I think when the calling came, he decided to move on and dedicate his life towards service of, more towards, the humanity. So I've always seen Maharaj is very eloquent and very deep in any subject matter he takes up. And one person, because of his knowledge of both material and spiritual sides, is very eloquently able and seamlessly able to actually combine the two together, present it in a manner which is easily understandable for, people of different ages. Rajiv, who's sitting here, I think maybe 30 years back, he used to travel with Maharaj to IITs, where Maharaj used to lecture at that time. And I think still he loves to associate with students, and I think students also love to associate with him because he has the patience to really answer, very, very difficult and tricky questions which students bring up. So Maharaj travels very widely throughout the world, I would say, and keeps lecturing at colleges, universities, programs. His base is Belgaum, where I would say he also spends time on creating a sustainable, eco-friendly community. But most of the time, I'm sure he's really out of Belgaum. Maharaj has recently lectured in Singapore, a similar Artha program, where my colleague Rajiv was there. And it was a phenomenal success. I think whoever came there, a lot of professionals who came there, are basically thirsting for one more program as soon as possible. So I think we should have one program this year. Depending on Maharaj's availability, there will be one more program planned out. So something about the Artha Forum, I would like to say. It's a brainchild of Rajiv and Kushal, two people who are here. Both of them are here. And it came out of their experience from a company which they incubated, grew, and then sold off. And they were guided by His Holiness Radhanath Swami Maharaj in terms of how and in what manner to really run this company. Without greed, without pride, for the benefit of society. And one key factor which I think was there was how to make charity as a core of the business itself. So many times we do reflect, we have got associated because we are, working together. So I normally see that charity is, you know, part of a lot of businesses, a lot of families, but it's a subsidiary activity. You know, if you make money, maybe you will donate X amount. If you don't, you know, people just don't donate. In many cases, it's all related to tax benefits, which people like to take. And in some cases, you have seen like the new companies law, which has come up, where government is trying to actually enforce, saying that, you know, X amount of profit needs to be put into CSR activities, so that, you know, companies are forced to do something which probably they have never done before, or they would have never liked to do at all. So after the success of the business which they had started, and where charity was at the core of the business, I think it was decided that why don't we take this message to businessmen, entrepreneurs, professionals who are there, and present it to them, because it's quite likely that many of them would like the message and would like to take it up. So that is how Artha Forum was born. And sometime in December 2012 is when we had the first forum meeting. This was at a place called Govardhan Eco Village on the outskirts of Mumbai. And after that, we have had about 7 or 8 meetings, both within the country as well as outside. And we have received an excellent response to that. So there are quite a few businesses and business leaders who came forward and who have tried to sort of come back and say that, yeah, we would also like to make charity as a core to the business. Now, it could be, you know, any charity, but at least that thought is there. Secondly, what we saw was that in some business families which we met, is which have done extremely well, maybe in the first generation, the motivation of the second and third generation to run the business was not very high, right? Because maybe there's enough wealth which has been created. But in one or two of the businesses, when we spoke to the second or third generation and presented to them the philosophy, I think they got very, very attracted towards that. And there have been some businesses which have been created, other than maybe their family business, where they have tried to make charity as their core motive. So within a short span of maybe 1.5 years, to get some of the people to dedicate part of their business profits to charity, I think has been a you know, successful exercise. And we want to take this forward to as many people. Artha Forum tries to unite, or tries to get together on a common platform, the entrepreneurs, business people, and bring forward the philosophy how charity can be core to the business, not a subsidiary activity. So I would like to actually take you through, maybe there's a presentation which is already going on about Artha Forum, so in case people would like to just go through that. It tries to bring forward the wisdom of ancient India into modern business, how the two can be combined together and getting, you know, a lot of business community people together. Generating wealth as well as embracing, you know, spiritual values in a socially conscious way without greed and pride. I think that is one of the core tenets of this Artha. Okay, these are some of the programs which we wanted to highlight, which have happened across the globe. There have been two programs which have... So we have had one in Pune. This is the third program in Mumbai. The first one we had at the Eco Village, which is outskirts of Mumbai. So this is some of the photographs about the Eco Village program. We had almost 60 participants for 4 countries who participated in that. Some of them are Silicon Valley entrepreneurs. This is a program which we had in the Silicon Valley. there were two programs we had over there last year and one program this year. So one program was in one of the Silicon Valley entrepreneur, Mr. Sushant Patnaik's house, and the other was at the Thai Global headquarters. So you see some of the photographs about that program. And again, we had one more program this year. So this is a program which we had last year where you see His Holiness Radhanath Swami Maharaj speaking to an eminent group of industrialists. You see Ajay Piramal there, Dr. Desai, Amit Chandra from Bain Capital. This was a program which we had at HSBC headquarters where Maharaj was invited to speak to 600 to 700 bankers. And this is in New Jersey, a program which we had last year. Again, we had an eminent group of industrialists who participated in this very enthusiastically. So some of the names of people who have participated in various programs, many of them are entrepreneurs in their own right, both in India and abroad. And so these are some of the programs which are coming up. One in Singapore planned this year, and the other big one which is being planned in January 2015. This is a three-day program at the Govardhan Eco Village. There is capacity for about 100 people. We already have about 10-15 people from overseas who have registered for this program. So it's a very interesting and exciting place which is there. So these are some of the quotes by His Holiness Radhanath Swami during the program. Yeah, so this is briefly about Artha. I think we just wanted to have a 1 minute, about Maharaj. So just quickly we can go through that before we get on to the main lecture. No? Okay. So Maharaj is not very keen on any videos. So I think we would get on with the main session. The topic is the Dharma of Business. Very interesting. And would like to invite Holiness Bhakti Rasamrit Maharaj to please come. And Rajiv, I think, where's the garland? Yeah, and Rajiv to garland Maharaj. Just one or two quick announcements in terms of the schedule which is there. We will have about an hour's lecture followed by question answers, followed by, you know, dinner prasadam which is there. And during the dinner prasadam, you know, any questions people want to ask Maharaj informally, they can do that. Some announcement related to housekeeping. Request everybody to put their mobiles on silent. And there is a washroom which is just outside. So in case somebody needs to go to the washroom, we will have somebody accompany them from outside. Hare Krishna. Thank you.
Om Ajnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamahyam Dadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yutapadakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padang Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhanvitamscha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Preshthaya Bhutale Shri Mate Bhakti Vedanta Swamin Nitinamine Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Vancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. A very good evening to all of you. Thank you very much for coming this evening. It's a great pleasure to be here at the Artha Forum program once again. I have been to this forum on a couple of occasions earlier. It is always a pleasure to be amongst people who are well established in their own arenas in life, who have seen life, and as they say nowadays, who have been there, done it, and who are now looking for something higher in life, some higher purpose, beyond the humdrum of their regular routine existence in the professional world or the corporate world. The topic that I was requested to speak on today, a curiously interesting topic, the dharma of business. And the question arises that, is there any connection at all between the two? Is there any dharma in business? I met one gentleman who was saying, yes, my business, my religion is money, so this is a very good topic. Because I was sharing this with somebody I met, that this is a topic I'm asked to speak on elsewhere. So then that was his half-hearted or maybe half-serious comment. It is an interesting topic because the world is getting increasingly focused on business and economy. Yes, there are issues of terrorism, there are issues of crime, there are issues of social exploitation, and so on and so forth. But probably no topic occupies the minds of people more nowadays than economics. Industrialization, economy, and GDP, GNP, and so on and so forth. And in any political campaign in any country of the world, this is always a major topic, probably the fundamental point on which elections are fought. Everything has become focused to such a large degree on economics, and because modern day economics is largely industrial, especially in the quote unquote developed world, and increasingly so in the quote unquote developing world, that one can't escape the point of how business or economics in this world can become something that is very meaningful and beneficial for the world at large. Naturally, before we go on to the topic itself, it's necessary to understand the terms. The two important terms here are dharma and business. And I'll take the easier of the two first. Business is easier to deal with than dharma. So let's talk about business. Most of you, I presume, are in the field of business, in some or the other business, either as entrepreneurs, as working professionals, or in whatever capacity. When we speak of business, I'm sure there are different definitions that you could find either in the books of law or in books of management and so on. But I'm just trying to place a very simple common sense definition of the word business. The word business would mean any economic activity that is intended to create wealth. I don't think you would have any issue with this definition. It's a very simple definition, shorn of all the technicalities that would come into strict textbook definitions. I use the term economic because any activity that gives rise to wealth may or may not be economic, because the word wealth also has to be understood properly. But in general, when we speak of business, yes, we are talking about any economic activity that is intended to create wealth. The intention is, of course, important. And what is wealth then? That's the next question. Wealth is, of course, commonly understood today as being the green note, as the bank balance, as property, as material assets that appear in your balance sheets, gold, or anything of material value. So we consider that as being wealth. Certainly, that's also wealth, but it's only one kind of wealth. It's an important kind of wealth, but there it is today. It has acquired a prominence and a role, perhaps in my humble opinion, far greater than it deserves. Not that we can do without it. Any society, any civilization, any individual needs some form of economic activity for sustenance and survival. No society can do without a platform or a foundation of some economic system. And naturally, as spiritualists, we are not impractical. We do recognize the need for a sound economic foundation for the society in which we live. And in the pursuit of the overall good of the society, economics plays a very important role, and so does business. When wealth is generated in terms of physical assets, like property, money, and so on, then there is a lot that can be done with it. There are many tangible and intangible things that come out of it. And therefore, businesses now start focusing more on generating profits. And profit becomes the overriding goal. Actually, I remember that way back even in the 1950s, there was a famous management thinker called Peter Drucker. I'm sure you've all heard of him. In those days, in the 1950s, he was far ahead of his times, actually. He spoke about management and business not being for profit alone. So thinkers, even in the last century, the 20th century, have come around to the idea that it's not all about money. But somehow or the other, for reasons which I'll briefly touch upon as we go along, the money or profit factor has become so very prominent that it seems to have eclipsed all other facets or aspects of wealth and business. You've all heard of the famous economist Milton Friedman. Way back in the 70s sometime, he famously declared that the most important responsibility of business was to generate profits. So long as businesses stayed within the rules of the game, then it was important to generate profit. No doubt, without generating profit, a business can't exist, it can't sustain. But Milton Friedman's proclamations eventually gave rise to a free market economy. He launched it, and thereafter there was a huge surge of free market activity that culminated in many, many tragic events in the commercial world. But not before. There was a movie in the late 1980s, I believe, or the mid-80s or late-80s, called The Wall Street. And they had this iconic mantra, which said, "Greed is good." And reflecting back on it, I think what they really meant and what it eventually turned out to be as time passed further was that what they probably meant was greed is God. And that is actually what is being the driving force for economic activity down the ages in history. However, if we look deeper, even though human nature has prevailed and greed has been a primary factor in driving economic activity, does it have to be so always? Are there any other alternative paradigms for driving business? As Milton Friedman's proclamations have taken a root in the society, and as the free market economy has grown by leaps and bounds, many things have happened, and many tragic events have also taken place. We have had all sorts of stock market crashes, we've had recessions, depressions, and many, many other catastrophic events in the world of economics and business. And thinkers have got around to questioning the basis of capitalism. Of course, capitalism has always been a matter of great discussion and debate. And even as far as 100 years ago, and even before that, we had Karl Marx, who came up with the response to capitalism, which had taken great force because of the Industrial Revolution and the Renaissance before that. And then the Communist Revolution took place in Russia, and then it spread like anything. And communism took the viewpoint that basically capitalism, in which the free market forces are let loose, basically are nothing but tools of exploitation, wherein certain privileged classes of people, the bourgeois, they exploit the ordinary people, the proletariat. So this was a fundamental paradigm, a principle on which the Marxist philosophy, the communist philosophy was based. And then they were successful for many, many years. But eventually they could not sustain. The Soviet Union collapsed. In China, you may have a political communism of sorts, but the economy is very much capitalistic. And we see that the model that the communists put forward is also not something very sustainable. Why so? This brings to mind a quote, which is one of my favorite quotes. Unfortunately, though I don't remember who was the one who said it. On the subject of exploitation of people within different political and economic systems, this person said that communism is the reverse of capitalism. In capitalism, man exploits man, and in communism, it's the reverse. And that's what you see. People start off with idealistic notions and ideas. When we were in school, we read this book called Animal Farm by George Orwell. It was a satire on the communist setup. And you had a farm, and you had the owner of the farm. Of course, that was way back when we were very small. And then the different animals, they all played out the whole communist system, how it happened, and eventually how there was some who were more important than the others, some who were more equal than the others. And eventually we see later on that the communist system also turned out to be a forum of exploitation. So one of our great thinkers of modern times, a spiritualist, the founder acharya of our movement, Srila Prabhupada, used to say that these different isms that have come into play in modern intellectual thinking in the modern age, in this century, the previous century, are all basically different forms of exploitation. Whether it is capitalism, whether it is communism or socialism or Fabianism or any other kind of ism, they are all essentially forms of exploitation. Because even though some of them may be well-intentioned, they do not take into account the fundamental flaw, and the flaw is human nature. And fundamentally, unless we rectify human nature, no political or economic system is really going to work. And none of the political or economic systems that are discussed amongst the intellectual circles or the academic circles in economics and political science and so on address this fundamental point. Because they are essentially materialistic, therefore in communism also you find dialectic materialism. So Srila Prabhupada talked about dialectical spiritualism as an antidote to the materialistic philosophy of the modern day politics and economics. So dialectic spiritualism addresses the root problem, which is human nature. And unless this human nature is dealt with, unless the rough edges of the human psyche are smoothened out, unless the essential spirituality or the divinity of the individual human being is not brought to the fore, any form of economic or political activity or indeed social activity also will merely be one or another form of exploitation. So therefore, the history of this world is a history of exploitation, of one exploiting another. And interestingly, it is all in the pursuit of equality. In the pursuit of equality that exploitation becomes even more prominent. Because human nature is such, and nature itself is such, that it does not, unfortunately, accommodate egalitarianism. It does not accommodate equality. We see a kind of variety and diversity in nature that is impossible to undo. That's how nature is. That doesn't mean that we justify exploitation, but what we do say is that within this diversity, if we address the fundamental spiritual unity that underlies this diversity, therein lies our solution. Today we have a form of capitalism or any other kind of ism that has run amok. So we have economic systems and political systems that are being powered or driven by the baser human instincts, greed, lust, envy, anger, pride, and ego. So long as these remain the driving forces or the impetuses for our political, economic, and social activities, humanity will not know any peace. And because economics or business activity is such an important part of life in this world, an inseparable part of human life, therefore, we can't compartmentalize it. One gentleman I was speaking to, he was asking me some questions about his personal business dealings. And when I asked him to tell me what he was going to do, it seemed very clear that it wasn't quite right. I'm putting things mildly. So then I said, you know, that's not quite right. You know, I wouldn't say yes to this. Why did you ask me this? So he said, you know, that I think you're not being practical. So I said, I think I'm being very practical. But it's a question of what values you cherish in your life. If you think of your business activity as being a different compartment, as being something that is separable or different from the other aspects of your life, then you run into a problem. And this is where we come to dharma. The word dharma, of course, is very difficult to really understand and define. But we have a sense of what the word dharma means in terms of something beyond the ordinary. And I'll come to that in a few moments. So when we think of our business activity, our job, our profession as one department that is exclusive, that is separate from our social life, from our personal life, maybe even from our religious life or spiritual life, then we run into difficulty. We don't see how dharma runs seamlessly through and under all the different aspects of our life. It's not that dharma is one part that's only at home or only in our personal belief. And then when we enter into business life, then we are completely different people. And it's a different me that acts there. Real dharma actually induces us to be the same person everywhere. Of course, externally we do have to behave differently, naturally. But the values that we cherish should be the values that underlie all different aspects of our life. Because this underlying set of values has somehow become weakened, so we have rampant materialism that drives everything in the world. To the degree that we drive away our spiritual nature from the focus of life, to the degree that we neglect our own underlying spirituality and our higher nature and give prominence to our lower natures, to that degree everything will become more and more materialistic. And to the degree that things become materialistic, things will become grosser and grosser and baser. Let me give you a simple example. You know the word education. When you talk of education today, you talk of someone getting a BA or a BE or a BSc, an MBA or Chartered Accountant's degree or something like that. This is education. But this actually is not what the term originally intended to mean. What we call education today, at least as is imparted in the colleges and universities, is simply information of how we can deal with this world. It's data. It's information. It's what we could call bread and butter knowledge. But the original understanding of the word education was that it's something that helps you to bring out your innermost spiritual nature. That which brings out, which is that which is deep within us. That is really what education is all about, real education. But today it has become grosser and grosser. Let's consider the meaning of another term, psychology. Psycho and logos. The science of the soul. That was the original understanding of the word psychology. Then it became a little gross. It became the science of the mind. And now it's become even more gross. Science of human behavior. So as time goes on, things become grosser and grosser because we become more and more materialistic in our outlook, in our philosophy of life. And with things becoming grosser, we become more and more distanced, separated from our real spirituality and therefore real happiness and peace in life. Consequently, the conception of wealth therefore also becomes grosser and grosser. Again, interestingly, the word wealth, I looked up the etymology of the word wealth. It comes from the old English word welle or weal, which means the overall welfare or well-being of people, that which produces joy and happiness for everyone. Of course, now we may say money produces joy like no other thing in life. Money is honey after all. But the conception of the word wealth, even in the English language, what to speak of Sanskrit and other older cultures, is that it talked about the overall well-being and happiness of people. So when you said that this was a wealthy society, you meant that there was a society in which the people were overall very happy. But today, because the word wealth has assumed such a gross physical connotation, a baser connotation, so we talk of wealthy countries or wealthy societies or wealthy people in terms of mere material assets. We also define development and success and happiness in these terms. When I was in Singapore for the Artha Forum program, I spoke about the idea of the gross national happiness. I mentioned, and this was way before our Prime Minister visited Bhutan and Bhutan became the focus. Bhutan is the only country, even though it's so tiny, where I think that there was some real wisdom in the economic planning. They said, let's go beyond GDPs and GNPs and let's talk of gross national happiness. And they defined happiness in different terms, not just in terms of monetary development, not in terms of economic development. They have redefined social development. They talk of it in terms of culture, in terms of values, in terms of morals, in terms of brotherly and sisterly relationships amongst people, the love and trust amongst people. They talk of it in terms of religion, of spirituality. So here we have a composite concept of development. And they see business or economic development as one aspect of it all. But today we have placed inordinate emphasis on economic development. And therefore we're just hearing in the newspapers, either you're hearing some information about some crimes that have taken place, or you hear news about economics, or you hear and see pictures of just the basest entertainment. I wouldn't even call it entertainment. Even the modern newspapers of today, that's another story, another time. So just see how far we have gone on. So therefore, when we talk of business, we lose sight of the wider ramifications of our goals of business, and we say profit and profit alone. And then gradually we come up with the idea of non-profit or not-for-profit. Some economists have talked about wealth in terms of anything of value. That's much better. However, when you go even deeper, then you think of wealth in terms of the originally intended meaning. Wealth in terms of something that is for the genuine and overall well-being and happiness of others. So we may have people who are financially not well off, but they're very, very happy. Today, we are measuring success in terms of how much of material assets that we possess. But richness or wealth is not defined, really speaking, in terms of how much we have, but in terms of how much we can be without. How much you can do without, happily. The degree to which we are dependent on excessive material comforts and assets doesn't actually indicate wealth, but actually indicates a lack of it. I'm sorry if I'm speaking really out of the box here. So I'm trying to turn conventional modern wisdom on its head to say that what we think is wealth isn't really wealth at all. Today's economics and paradigms of development speak of increasing our wants. But development is not, especially economic development, is not a matter of unlimitedly increasing our wants. It's a matter of transcending them. It's a matter of going beyond them to recognize that the lesser we can do with or the material sphere, the better it is for the overall happiness development index. So for those who are economists and business people, here are some ideas that we need to think about, some food for thought. We need to think seriously about these things instead of measuring development in terms of monetary assets and other physical things. Let's also talk of other paradigms. Now, when there are programs for development, quote-unquote development, that different governments place out, there is also strong opposition from people who may be, let's say, left of the center. We have these words, right of center, left of center. Capitalism and modern-day development is considered right of center. And then you have those who are left of center who may oppose such development. And sometimes such opposition is on very sound footing. Sometimes the points that they raise are very valid, very good. However, the solutions they offer are also not perfect, because even they do not address the fundamental point, that is, human nature needs to be addressed. And it is here that I come to the point of dharma. So having talked about wealth and discussed it at some length, we come to a more difficult topic of dharma, which is very hard to define and even harder to translate into the English language. Depending on the context, the word dharma could mean so many different things. In ordinary parlance, the word dharma usually refers to a religion. He is of this dharma, he is of that dharma. So in a very gross sense, you talk about it as religious faith. He's a Hindu, he's a Muslim, he's a Christian, he's a Jain, he's a Sikh. That's actually not really the understanding of the word dharma. Somehow or the other, this seems to have come into popular usage now. But that is not what real dharma is about, although it's one connotation of the term. Ontologically speaking, the word dharma indicates that which upholds everything. It comes from the verbal root dhri. Dhri in Sanskrit is a verbal root that means to sustain, to uphold, to bear, to support. So dharma is that which is the underlying support for all that exists. A very broad term. And when it speaks of supporting everything that exists, we naturally also speak of economic activity. So dharma is also that which sustains economic activity or business. So today we have a scenario in which we have business activities devoid of any sensitivity for dharma, for the fundamental support of creation. Because of that, there is an inherent imbalance. There is some form of disturbance. The word dharma can also be understood in terms of being that one defining quality which characterizes any particular entity and which cannot be separated from that entity. For example, we speak of the dharma of sugar as being sweetness. We speak of dharma of water as being fluidity. We speak of the dharma of fire as being heat and light. When you take away these essential qualities from these entities, they don't remain those entities any longer. So these are the defining characteristics of those entities by which they are known as fire or water and so on. So similarly, what is our dharma? Our dharma is that set of values. Our dharma is that higher purpose for which we all exist. And unless we explore the higher dimensions of life and why we are here in this world, we will never be able to reconcile and synergize dharma with business. Business will always remain a separate activity, and dharma, if at all, also another separate activity. There's another connotation to dharma. I'll get down to this idea a little later. But there's another idea of dharma which is more down to earth, more practical, and it's called Sanatana Dharma. Sanatana means eternal. And here we are talking of principles that are eternal, that don't change with time. We may apply these eternal principles according to time, place, and circumstance differently, according to need. But the fundamental principles do not change. Let's consider then the role of business from this point of view. Let's give the example of a human body. In the human body, we have the head, which is very important because it contains the brain that directs the body. Without the brain, naturally there is no life possible, or even if life is possible, there doesn't seem to be any meaning. You know, you could live with a stomach ailment, you could live with a chronic back ailment or some other injury, but to live with a deranged mind is very hard. It's very dysfunctional. Instinctively, we try to protect our head first. If you go somewhere, you hear a loud noise somewhere, something falling, your hands immediately go to protect your head. Because you understand that's the most precious part of your body. You don't protect your hand, you know, the hand goes here. Because even if you lose a hand, you can live, but you lose your head, you can't live. Or if the head is excessively damaged, then your existence is very dysfunctional. So the head leads, gives guidance to the body. Okay, lift your hand, place it forward, lift this item, place it in your mouth. The guidance comes from the brain, from the head. Then you have the hands, which perform the function of moving things, grasping things, lifting things, without which we can't survive also. And then there are the legs, which serve the function of moving the body from one place to another place. Locomotion or transportation, very, very important for us. And ultimately, there is the torso which includes the belly, the stomach, the digestive system, the liver and everything else, performs a very important function. It ensures that the nutrition that has been ingested into the body is now thoroughly digested, assimilated, and the nutrients have been spread everywhere throughout the body for the welfare of the entire body. So the torso is definitely very important. So this analogy can be given to the social body as well. You can think of society as a body. You have those who are intellectuals, who are philosophers, thinkers, in any area of human activity. Also could be economics, could be business, could be spirituality, could be anything. But they are thinkers. Their job is to think. And they come up with guidelines that govern the functioning of the people in general. So the thinkers are the most important part of the society, because without thinking, the society would break down. And then you have those who actually serve to protect the body, those who serve to move things. They are the administrators, the military people, those who rule, those who govern. That's also very, very important in the society. And you have people who also help in other important activities, different aspects of labor, of creative work, and so on, without which also human society is incomplete. And then finally, you have the business field, the field of economics, in which wealth is generated. Fundamentally, wealth is generated only from this one section of society. And the wealth that is generated from there serves to nourish every other part of the social body. And that is what business is all about. So business is a seed for the generation or the creation of wealth. And wealth of all kinds. And such creation of wealth by the economic class or the business community, the business class of people in this world, should nourish all aspects of one's existence. When the dharma of the business community is to be, shall we say, stabilized, it means that the business activity should be in harmony with all aspects of the social body. Inasmuch as the body, the stomach, the intestines, they nourish the entire system, the nutrition is transmitted everywhere, so the economic strata in society will also spread the nourishment and nutrition, or the wealth, so to speak, everywhere. So the business community has a very, very important role to play in generating the well-being of society. Because without money in this world, it is very hard to do everything. Yes, as a spiritualist, even I'm saying that. That money is necessary. Dharma does not deny the importance of money. Dharma does not deny the importance of economic activity. Rather, dharma actually includes economic activity as one of the very, very important activities of human society, but it cautions us that that is not the only thing. That is not the be-all and end-all of human society to achieve material prosperity. That economic activity, material prosperity, important as they may be in life, are not ends in themselves, but they are actually meant for a higher purpose. They are means to an end. So business activity performed in a very dharmic way can actually transform the world. Because money is power. And when power is wielded by people who are dharmic, then it can do good to the society. But if that power that comes in through money and other forms of wealth is in the hands of people who are not dharmic, it can cause havoc everywhere. What do we mean by business causing or creating wealth that is in harmony with the nature around us? The easiest and simplest way that we could understand this is in terms of environment, that is the most commonly understood form. There's much more to it, of course. For example, now what's occupying the minds of people everywhere is pollution, global warming, climate change, and industries are becoming increasingly subject to restrictions, very stringent laws, with regard to polluting the atmosphere, the water, the land, and so on. Of course, that is only one aspect of it. No doubt, pollution of the environment is one thing that has happened very significantly because of modern business. It continues to happen in a huge scale even now. But that's not it all. There's much more. When we speak of living in harmony with that which sustains us, the environment is obviously a very important thing. But we speak of the environment not just as a physical environment of the land, the sky, the water, and so on. We are also speaking of the cultural environment. We are speaking of the psychological environment. We are speaking of the social environment, the religious and spiritual environment. Does business have a role to play in these areas? Yes, indeed. I remember several years ago, I was told by somebody that he had met the continental marketing director of a multinational company. And this lady was in charge of marketing some cereal products to the whole of Asia. And she met this person who later spoke to me, and she said, you know, our marketing strategy is to make Indians stop eating hot food. Why? Because so long as the culture of eating hot food exists, you're not going to buy the cereals. You'd rather have your breakfast that is cooked and eaten hot at home. If you have to promote cereals, then you have to undermine this culture of eating hot food cooked at home. So just look at it from an angle, from a purely marketing or a marketing point of view, it may seem like a brilliant strategy. But is it dharmic? The environmental issue aside, now we are talking of something that is social, that is cultural, that has ramifications that go very deep. In the pursuit of profitability, is that something a company should be doing? Should that be a part of the strategy of a corporation to try to undermine, indeed, even destroy the very cultural and social foundations of a society in order that its products may penetrate the market in that society? And that's a very deep question. So these are strategies that corporations often make, businesses often make. And perhaps they are not stated so expressly, and sometimes perhaps they are. But this is something to think about. It's a simple example of how the pursuit of wealth, when devoid of sensitivities to the culture, to society, to the environment, etc., can create so much damage. So when we adopt business strategies that have no regard for ethics, for society, for social values, then we end up disturbing the harmony. That which underlies the society is being thrown out of balance. For example, the family unit is undoubtedly the unit of society. When the family unit crumbles, society crumbles. Keep aside religion. Let's just talk about the society as a whole. Nowadays, we see, especially as I travel in the Western countries, and it happens increasingly in India as well, the family unit is crumbling. You hardly have families now that live together. In the UK, someone gave me a newspaper article. There are 34 types of families that are defined in the law. 34 types. And I was really wondering, this is really ingenious. How have they come up with 34 types of families? So I was curious to know how those 34 types of families are defined. And the good old family, mother, father, children, is just one in those 34. And what are the other types of families that you have? Then you have a family in which there is a single mother with children, or you have a single father with children. Then you have another category, a single mother with a child who is married a man, and that's another category of family. And the next category is the man also has children from another marriage. So then you have another kind of unit. And there are combinations and permutations of all these. And it was mind-boggling as I went through the entire list of 34. And then, of course, there was two men marrying each other and staying and adopting a child. Two ladies marrying each other, adopting a child, which is recognized as a family unit. So the whole series of such family units coming up. But ultimately, at the end of the day, the very spirit of the essence of the good old family is gone. And when you take away that foundation from society, what are you taking away? You're taking away its very soul. So when a business, as a strategic tool, targets this very foundational principle of society, then we understand that is something very insidious, something that really is something we should take note of. Similarly, the entire advertising propaganda that goes on as a part of the strategy of promoting the products also affects religious ideas, it affects the social setup psychologically. I do a lot of work in the villages as well. And when I'm in the villages, even sometimes in the most remote villages, there is television there. You will see these huge antenna, and somehow or the other, this is also considered a part of development, a development criterion that we must reach computers and televisions even to the remotest of villages. And when we go there, these are people who are living way out in the mountains, sometimes in the interiors. They haven't even visited a big city in their life, perhaps. And the only exposure to urban life they've had is perhaps the nearest taluka place or something, tehsil. And here you have the razzle-dazzle of glitter and glamour of Bollywood and New York and Bombay and everything coming into their rooms. And I see these people, they are mind-boggled. They just sit there wonder-struck to see all that is going on. They see the culture that's coming through on the television. They see the lifestyle. They see the values. And they want to, then the young children, they want to imitate the Bollywood dancers. Yes, that's what's happening there. So the television companies or the government agencies, who wants to promote, they promote this with the idea that this is development. The intentions may or may not be good, sometimes even if they are good, but we have to see that it is backed by proper understanding of dharma. What are we doing to these people? What are we doing to their psychology? What are we doing to their social setup? It's one thing to say and to desire that they come out of poverty, that they have basic things in life. And actually, I can tell you from my personal experience of dealing with these people that even though, relatively speaking, they may appear to be very poor, quality of life that they lead is much better than I have seen in most urbanites. Yes, they have their quarrels too. They have their marital quarrels. They have their social quarrels. They have their village politics. That's there. But the quality of life that we lead there, the simplicity of their life, the way they live in harmony with nature, with each other, the contentment, the peace of mind that they have is something that even the richest person in this world would probably not have. There's another little story which I like to cite often because it's such a telling story. I've said this quite a few times over the last year or two. One time several years ago, one of the wealthiest people in the world was interviewed on the television. And after the discussion on business was over, then the interviewer asked this person, "Mr. So-and-so, you've got everything that anybody in this world could possibly want to have. You've got so much money that by the time you count your wealth, the wealth has increased and we have to start all over again. So now, if God were to appear before you, what would you ask for?" And pat came the reply, "A little happiness. A little happiness, not much happiness, Because much happiness is something that is a distant dream, probably. A little happiness, just a little. And here are these simple, poor folk living in the interior villages. Such sublime living. And here we are, in the name of progress and development, terrorizing them into other notions of economic development, infringing, barging into their lives, taking advantage of their simplicity and gullibility and innocence, and bringing temptations into their life which they could well do without, which they were far happier without. And ever since these things have come, their life has changed drastically. Sometimes when I talk to the elders in these interior villages, they say that now the television has come, and now that this has happened and that has happened, we are quarreling so much more. Earlier, this was never there. We were living as one family in the village. And everything was so nice and harmonious. But now, ever since these things have come, we have become distanced from each other because everyone is becoming more self-centered. Because as materialism, as the powers of greed, lust, anger, envy, they start filtering in through television, through industry, and so on and so forth, gradually the simplicity and the higher values of life start subsiding. Today, the whole agenda of governments world over, create jobs, create jobs, create jobs, isn't it? That was what Obama's campaign was, one of the things it was based on. And here also in India, we hear so much about creating jobs. The idea should be to enable people to stand on their own feet. And the people in the villages are doing exactly that. They're not working in jobs, working at the mercy of somebody else, but they're living lives of dignity. They're sustaining themselves in an honorable way. Their life is simple, their needs are simple, but they have an economic paradigm that seems to be backward from the point of view of modern business thinkers. And therefore, they think that we must go there and give them our conception of development. And along with that conception of development comes all the ills and all the problems of modern day society that we bring. So therefore, when businesses act for the purpose of promoting their interests, if these interests are not promoted with due regard to cultural sensitivities, social sensitivities, economic needs, religious needs, spiritual needs, we will find a major disharmony. So therefore, when we speak of business being done in accordance with dharma, we are speaking of something that is very fundamental, where business is not just an activity that is an instrument for the fulfillment of my greed, an instrument for the fulfillment of my lust for power and name and prestige and position. But rather, business, because it can generate wealth and because it is an instrument of power, it can become a vehicle for social, economic, spiritual transformation. That is really how we synthesize and synergize dharma with business. I like the point Sanjeev mentioned about the Artha Forum, where he said that charity is at best seen by people as being something that has to be done, but as a subsidiary kind of activity. But the Artha Forum is trying to see that charity can be made one of the core activities of business, of any business. And that's a fact. Generally, if you ask anybody about corporate social responsibility, they will mostly tell you it is either a headache or it is just something that they have to do as a matter of compliance. It is not something that is being willingly done, happily done. It is not seen as something that is very intrinsic to the very core purposes of business itself, of life itself. The principle that I exist for others is the principle of what dharma is all about. When we start thinking of I exist for myself, then we have a problem. When we have the ideology of me living for others, my business too for others, and naturally, since I'm also, I have to sustain the business, profitability is good. Because without profits, the organization cannot sustain. So we generate profits, and I'm entitled as a promoter of a business to enjoy a part of the fruits of the business, but not everything. Because the stakeholders are numerous. Everybody is a stakeholder. Even the dharmic ideology extends even to simple agriculture. Generally, nowadays we find people take up processes that are very violent in terms of killing bacteria and other germs and so on, or pests in the agricultural field. But actually, they have a right to our agricultural produce as well. The birds have a right, the insects have a right. Because whatever we have, the soil, the seeds, the air, the oxygen, the heat, the light, and everything around it, and the technology that is within that seed that enables it to grow into a plant, are essentially all given to us. They're not man-made. So we have a debt to fulfill towards all these stakeholders. Not just our consumers or customers, not just the employees, not just the shareholders, not just the government, not just the environment, but to everybody and everything in existence. This is what dharma in business is all about. When the people running the business see that I have an obligation towards everything that exists, and therefore my business will be a vehicle for the service of everything that exists. This is a very broad conception of life, maybe hard to digest for many people. But that actually is such a beautiful and sublime idea. Just imagine if everybody were to follow a philosophy or a paradigm like this. It reminds me of one of the episodes from the Mahabharata, I believe, where there was a farmer who bought land from another farmer, and then while plowing the field one day, the one who purchased the farm discovered that his plow was stuck, and upon digging, he found that there was a treasure chest in that land. And he opened the chest, it was full of precious stones and diamonds and so on. So what would a modern farmer have done? He would have kept it with himself. But this man took it, he went to the person from whom he purchased the land and said, "Look, I found this on your land, so this is your property." Now, had it been somebody else, in the modern day, he would have said, "Yes, yes, it's mine, give it to me, give it to me." But he thought for a moment and said, "You know, I sold you the land, and everything that goes in the land is yours, it's not mine." And the other person responded, "But I didn't buy the treasure from you, I only bought the land from you." "But no, no," so it went on back and forth. Of course, even modern law, I don't know what the modern law is, but your proper, even when you buy land, your jurisdiction or your rights over the land extend only to a few feet. Then below that, you don't own the land belongs to the state or the government. In any case, so here what I'm calling for is a broadening of our consciousness to go beyond just my needs, me and my name and fame and position and prestige and money and enjoyment and house and cars and so on and so forth, to thinking of the world. This is what dharmic thinking is all about. I'd just like to conclude with a verse from one of the Sanskrit texts. Ayam nijaha paro vetti ganana lagu chetasam udara charitanam tu vasudhaiva kutumbakam. It's a famous verse. You must have heard the phrase vasudhaiva kutumbakam. The word vasudha, vasu means wealth. Dha is one who holds, feminine gender. Vasudha, the earth is called vasudha because she holds or she bears all kinds of wealth. So the entire earth is one family. Who thinks like that? Udara charitanam. One whose consciousness is very broad, who is large-hearted, whose consciousness has evolved beyond a greed and lust for power and prestige and so on. On the other hand, those who are of narrow mind, their thinking is, this is mine and I must have more of this. That is yours, this is mine. Laghu chetasam, of those whose consciousness is very narrow. So if we have business that is done with this idea, professionally run, then just imagine the good that business can do to the world at large. There was an economist or a sociologist about a century ago, a German called Max Weber. If I remember right, it was about a century ago. And his theory was that capitalism today is flawed because it is devoid of its religious and ethical foundation. And that is why materialism has taken over. And his theory, he was a Christian, so he said his theory was businessmen should be ascetics or something like that. And it should be almost like an ascetic, where you are detached from the fruits of your labor, like a yogi, something like the Bhagavad Gita, what it talks about. You do your business as a service to everything around you, to everything that exists. You don't see it as your own fiefdom, as something that is meant for your enjoyment and exploitation. So business that is done, that is devoid of the exploitative spirit, is business that is in accordance with dharma. And naturally, when we speak of altering human nature, which was a point that I was making in the beginning, then we talk of recognizing and assimilating this principle by adopting appropriate spiritual practices. And these spiritual practices are not dependent on one's particular religious faith. If one imbibes these essential principles, the broader principles to have this udara charita, this big-hearted approach to life, then business will never be a cause of problems to the world. Economic activity will actually be a cause of tremendous holistic transformation of this world. That would be business in accordance with dharma. There are, of course, many, many other concepts to give in the idea of dharma and how we can apply it to business. But this was just a preliminary introduction, and I wanted to share a few thoughts with you. Frankly, I have not had much time to apply my mind so much. I've rushed in from another place. Barely had time to just settle in and come in here. But I've tried to share with you some thoughts about dharma in connection with business. And I do hope that I have succeeded in providing you some food for thought, something that you will meditate upon and try to use in your personal and your professional life. I'd like to thank all of you very much for your patient hearing. You have been a very wonderful audience. And I would also like to thank the Artha Forum for inviting me for this program and for organizing programs like this, which I think are like churning sessions. You churn and churn and churn and let these ideas come up, which normally we don't get an opportunity to hear about because we are so involved and caught up in our day-to-day existence, the humdrum of our day-to-day life, going to one's job or business and coming back and then dealing with everything that we have to deal with. It is so necessary sometimes to take a step back and think about these deeper subjects, even when it comes to matters like business. So I'd like to thank the Artha Forum very much for organizing programs of this sort. And I believe we have some time now for questions, yes? So I would like to throw open the floor for questions. If any of you have any questions, please feel free to ask them, and I will try to answer the questions. You may just raise your hands and you can speak from wherever you are. We do have a mic as well.
Maharaj, it's really nice to hear your thoughts again. My question may sound a bit silly, but you know I keep bothering you with these silly questions. You mentioned, you know, living for others is probably a better way to sort of live their appropriate dharma. I think I personally struggle with this question of when do you say enough, this is enough, especially when that question does not pertain to you. As an individual, if I had to say this is enough, perhaps it's an easier philosophy to get to. But when I'm doing actions which pertain to, let's say, my children, I think it becomes a much harder question of saying when is enough materially or, you know, on the baser side. I think I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Thank you. Actually, no question is silly. It's a very good question. And I think sound issue? Okay, actually it's a very good and important question. How much is enough? Actually, the more you advance spiritually, the matter becomes clearer and clearer. The cobwebs move away. Our thinking is not clouded anymore. Clarity of thought comes in with the purification of the heart. And one sees, well, actually, I don't need this. Well, I really don't need that as well. Well, actually, I don't even need that. I can do without this. And I'm happy enough without it. And as we start moving in this path, we understand gradually what it is that we really need. And that is actually the hallmark or the standard by which we judge the advancement of a civilization, as I was mentioning earlier. So that's one point. The second point I'd like to make in this connection is a more practical nature. How much is enough? Well, we could talk about this and that, but let's say whatever I have now is enough. Let that be the standard. Very practical. Whatever I have now. If that's what I'm happy with, then I will become happy. You see, real wealth is peace of mind. Real wealth is contentment. If I'm contented with what I have today, I will be always contented. If I'm not contented with what I have today, I will never ever be contented whatever I may have. So therefore, that's the second part, a very practical thing. Your third part of your question was about children. That I may set a standard, but what about my children? Well, you see, that is the duty of the parents to imbibe certain values in the children. So as guardians for the children, it is up to the parents to see what kind of values the children should be imbued with. If we want the children also to be contented in life, they can be achievers, but contented. Not achievers in the sense of just figures and assets, but in a very holistic, complete, integrated sense. Then we will also try to make them understand and train them and give them what we call in Sanskrit the samskaras, those proper impressions, that proper upbringing, that training which makes them understand that you should be satisfied with what you have. I was told that Bill Gates is planning to leave not more than a very small percentage of his wealth to his children. Maybe 5%, 10%. Anyone knows the figures here? 10%. A very small, $10 million. Million. Million, not billion. Okay, million. And how many billion dollars is he worth? $58 billion. So out of $58 billion, he's leaving his children $10 million each. Now, something. You see, as time goes on, we see people are becoming, they're thinking, I must do this, I must do this. Warren Buffett, I read about him the other day, lives a very frugal life, lives in an apartment, doesn't have a huge palatial house. The same apartment that he lived in, I believe, many decades ago. He's contented with what he has. These are rare souls. He may or may not be very religiously inclined or spiritually inclined, I do not know. But at least by the way his contentment and the way he is able to live a life that is meant for others, that is something admirable. That is something that we can appreciate. So it's really up to us. What kind of values do we want to give? Usually we see that people or children who are brought up with a lot of wealth and have liberal access to that wealth also do not realize its value. It's easy come, easy go. So it is very important that they understand the necessity and the importance and the value of frugality, of how to value every penny. So the children are given these values, then they will understand. Then it will be easy for us to also implement these standards throughout. Right? Is there any other question? Yes.
Supposed to do their duty and they're supposed to provide, do their, it's actually their dharma, isn't it? I mean, your dharma as a police officer, as a police constable, as a prime minister, whatever level you might be at. Why don't people, what's going to make them realize that this is their dharma and they should, do their job and not continuously, filch from what is around them just because they have the ability to do so?
Yes, that is another dimension of dharma which I didn't touch upon, because dharma is such a multifaceted term. Dharma also implies playing one's role and performing one's duty as, let's say, a father or mother, or as a police constable, or as anything else. So one of the problems that we see here is a lack of chastity to one's work. We are not sincere to our work. The police constable, all the way up to, way up to the very, very top of all the levels of power would be, if they are really faithful to their work and their responsibility, this would never happen. So there is a problem of dharma here, as you rightly said, that they haven't understood dharma. Why? Because of a lack of spiritual education, a lack of understanding of dharma. Materialism has taken over. And because of this, there is a complete separation from one's dharmic nature. One has got so caught up with the tidal wave of materialism that's sweeping the world that now these ideas seem very alien. And indeed, it seems so natural that you just, you're supposed to do it. I remember many years ago, there was one particular minister in some state government who was arrested, or there was some scam about him having awarded contracts to his relatives. And it was a huge sum of money, and the matter came up in the press, it was in the television and everything. And in one interview, the reporter asked him that, we have heard that you have awarded contracts and you've engaged in favoritism or nepotism to your relatives. Is it true? You've been partial to your relatives. So his immediate response was, if I'm not partial to my relatives, then should I be partial to your relatives? Quite an intelligent man. So it was just something that's so normal. It's just, of course, I mean, I have to do it because they are my relatives. I have to do that. Why do you even doubt or question such a thing? It means that this land of spirituality has undergone a great transformation. In the blind pursuit for wealth, something has fallen through our fingers. In gathering all that money, our very soul has fallen through. The very essence of our dharma has fallen through. And what remains of religiosity is just an external skeleton of something that is a mere resemblance, if at all anything, just a superficial resemblance to it. But there is no real genuine spirituality or real religion over there. So it actually needs a lot of churning, a lot of education. It needs a lot of good role models in society. Then these things can be changed by positive energy. You know, the greatest changes in the world have been made by individuals. It's one person of extraordinary caliber and integrity and character who came up and revolutionized the world. For good or for bad, that's another thing, but they caused change. Hitler, Lenin, so many. So similarly, we need not be discouraged by looking at the bleak scenario around us. The world will be what it is. We cannot alter the world more than what we can. But what we can do is to remain steadfast in our dharma. So we are steadfast in our dharma, regardless of what happens to the rest of the world. We are at least true to ourselves. And such examples are what are needed in the society. Because of lack of role models, we have problems. I remember here in this very temple, this was in the late 1980s, and I used to live here at that time, and we had some frequent telephone problems. Those days we didn't have mobile phones, of course, and our landline used to keep getting disconnected, and I was wondering what's happening. And then we used to call the telephone man every time, and then he would, with great difficulty, then he would come, and then he would go to the pole and he would do something, and then, you know, it was set right, and then we'd have to give him a little bakshish, and he would go away. Finally, it dawned on me that something is amiss here, that this thing was being done deliberately. So it took me quite a while. And then finally I called this man, and I said, look, this, then I had a heart-to-heart talk with him. And I said, look, why are you doing this? What's the reason? And he wasn't embarrassed. At that time, there had been a chief minister in the state who had been involved in some big cement scandal some years before that. So he said, well, if the chief minister of the state can swindle crores and crores, I can just take a few rupees. What is the problem? Well, I said, but not from the temple. At least spare us, I told him. Anyway, I had a little chat with him after that, and I tried to explain a few things to him, but so that's what it means. So if we have role models in business, in professional life, in every area of life, then that can transform the society. Today, our role models are in Bollywood, are in sports, and that's all the newspapers and magazines and TV, that's what they're all about. So everybody follows them. But if we have people of impeccable integrity and caliber who become the role models in society and stand firm even in the midst of the tsunamis of everything that goes on around them, these are people of real caliber. These are the real heroes and heroines of the modern era, not the Bollywood heroes and heroines. Right? Is there any other last questions? Yes, it's okay.
Swamiji, you said that business should be an integral part of the daily living in terms of that it cannot be separated from our spiritual practice.
Yes.
So in general, what happens is that, when we start, I guess that you try to have, you know, let's say the morning hours, you're doing your chanting or you're doing your spiritual practice, and then you go for the work, and then that kind of becomes a little departmentalized, which should not be, as you said. So my question is that how do you integrate the your professional work or the business with the spiritual practice, in the sense that can it be integrated into your devotional service, that it becomes a service to Lord itself? So the whole thing is kind of seamless and integrated.
Well, that's an important question of how do you see everything as a seamless one part of your life, one life, that you don't have departments. This is your religion, this is your, even if you're not a religious person, and this is your family, this is your profession. You know, even on the platform of not being a very firm believer in God or anything like that, the fundamental thing is basically to cultivate that consciousness by proper association. As far as professional life is concerned, we can see our professional or business life as part of that integrated whole, provided we cultivate that consciousness when we are not at work. we have our personal time, which is away from our profession and our business. That is the time we need to cultivate this consciousness by nurturing our intellect, by hearing things that we normally don't hear like this, and developing these attitudes and values that are conducive to this. Then when it will become seamless, when we move out into our business and our social life, then it's all one. Of course, we do have to play different roles, and we do have to act differently. We have to do the needful. When you're at business, you act in a certain way. When you're in the family, you may act in another way. But underlying that all is a consciousness that I talked about in the class. And that is cultivated especially at the times that we are not at work. Then we can carry through the consciousness during our working life as well. Okay, yes, there was one last question here.
Yeah, Swamiji, I wonder, just a question, just trying to understand better. If everybody right from their birth, right from the beginning, were very spiritual minded and knew how to be content, would there ever be the Bill Gates of the world at all? Would we actually stop developing? What are your perspectives on that?
Well, I guess everybody would be Bill Gates in that sense, that everybody would be sharing whatever they have with everybody. There are still villages today in India, and I did go to one of them, where they produce things for themselves in their fields, and whatever they have in excess of their needs, they distribute it free to the other villagers. And similarly with the others, when they grow extra vegetables which they don't need, they give it, they distribute it. Oh, there's something extra in our home today, please take it. And that's how they live. Just imagine such a life. They share everything with each other like they're one family. They don't charge each other. And they live like this. It's a question of sharing. So the more we become materialistic, the more we transform from the culture of sharing to a culture of grabbing. Right? Because everything becomes more self-centered. So therefore, by cultivating this consciousness, we start sharing. We start realizing that our goal is not just to fulfill some narrow selfish needs, but we have to go beyond that. So the culture of sharing is now made a popular, is spread as a standard practice and value for everybody, and that's how the children are trained, then we will have little Bill Gates everywhere in terms of how they share their assets and not selfish about keeping things to themselves. Right? Does it answer your question?
Sure.
Okay. All right, so I think I've gone beyond my time. I didn't realize how far. Thank you very much again for your very nice questions and also for your very patient hearing once again. Thank you.
Hare Krishna.
Thank you very much, Maharaj. I think it's going to take us some time to really digest whatever you have said, but very clearly what I said in the beginning in terms of how seamlessly you are able to combine economics and dharma and other things together is absolutely fantastic. What we are going to do is, I'm sure a lot of you would like to hear maybe some of what Maharaj said today again, and we'll try to put it, you know, give you a link to this particular lecture and send it to you by email, so that in case you would like to hear it again and sort of churn, as Maharaj said, churn it in your mind, think about it. So if you know, some people have not left their email IDs here, I request you to leave it here. One or two thoughts also came to my Maharaj while you were talking about, you know, the underlying dharma of business. And I was just thinking about, you know, even economically or from the social point of view, the government also expects businesses to follow some basic minimum dharma, whether it's related to ecology, it's related to maybe rights of stakeholders. And whenever businesses try to transgress those rights, you have these regulatory bodies and regulators and super regulators who are being imposed on businesses today. And businesses are all complaining all the time about the massive amount of regulations which they are going through. I think it's just increasing day by day. We also face it because there is somebody who's trying to, you know, go around the regulation and try to bypass that. But there is a basic level of understanding, I think, which maybe it's not so deep. It's at the superficial level, but there is a lot of regulations and regulators who are being imposed on business so that some basic level of, I would say, dharma is being followed. So we'll think about whatever you have said a little more deeply. And thank you very much once again, Maharaj, I think, for your time. I think it's been really fantastic to listen to something like this. Thank you.
It's a question of rights and duties. When you follow dharma, you're more concerned about your duties than your rights. When you're concerned with adharma, then you're more concerned about your rights rather than your duties. So that's the reason, actually. If everybody in the world is more concerned about their own duties rather than their rights, then the world will be a very happy place. And businesses will not need so much regulation.